my name's June. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Hi. I'm really delighted to be here. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't like everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard a speaker from Texas, and he said, if you like everyone in AA, you're not going to enough meetings. And something that I think about sometimes when I'm being a little bit too judgmental, I suppose. But I do love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love what it has managed to accomplish in my life. It's given me a life that I never wanted any part of. It's made me a person that I would have hated when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's really been just a series of paradoxes like that that has occurred. But I'm really grateful to be here, to see John and Helen is very special in my life. They're two people that I hope that those of you who stay in Alcoholics Anonymous can have friends like that, and I know that you will if you stick around Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon in these programs, because I know that they can offer that to you as they have to me. And I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me here. I've had a wonderful conference. Most of the people who've shared here, I have never heard before. And it's been just wonderful. You know, I, sort of like Tom was talking about giving examples, you know, this morning. I'm a big learner from examples. I gotta tell you very honestly that there's many speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't tell you their name or even where they're from, but I can tell you out there and things are tough or things are fun in my life. And I'm just a big example, you know, Gobbler. I had a great weekend. You know, I'm one of the few people in Alcoholics Anonymous who will be able to say that I had dinner one night with Bob Smith and Breck. And those of you who didn't know that was Bill's last name, and I know all of you know that Bob Smith was here. And it was just fun. I was thinking about that a lot this weekend, and just how fortunate I was to meet those two people. I've talked probably about a year and a half ago at a meeting local to where I live, and it was right near Easter. And when I finished speaking, this guy came up to me, mainly because his sponsor made him. You know how you can tell that. There was somebody bigger than him standing behind him, sort of pushing him up there. And this guy seemed to be fairly new, and he shook my hand. He said, I'd like to thank you for your talk. He said, I don't believe that was your story, but you told it very well. And I've thought about a lot about that since, because I'll guarantee you that the people who saw me come into Alcoholics Anonymous thought that I looked very much like my story. But it's only been in the years that I've stayed here that, that some people have had doubts that it was actually my story. I'm one of those people who happens to believe I was born an alcoholic. I don't want to get into any philosophical discussions with you about it after the meeting. It's something that I believe. I believe that because there was definitely something wrong with me long before I began to drink or take any other kind of chemicals. And my first obsession in life was suicide. It began at the age of 5 years old. And at that time, I began to try and cut my hands and fingers and wrists with razor blades any time that I could. I took overdoses of baby aspirin, which was all I knew about at that time. If I was left alone in a car, which I frequently was while my mom was in the bar drinking, I would take the car lighter and I would burn as many parts of my body as I possibly could. And there were a number of times when I had knives or I had hammers, and I would beat my face and my body with those things. Now, I know many of the people in this room and probably in a lot of other rooms are not going to identify with those kind of things. But that was the way that my life began. Those are the first memories that I have of life. You may be surprised when I tell you that I really was not a happy child. I was an observer of people. I was raised in an alcoholic home, my mother being the alcoholic, and my mom was a bar drinker. There was a lot of violence in my home. There was a lot of anger in my home. There were a lot of broken promises, just as there are in any other alcoholic home. And so I grew up knowing a lot about alcoholism firsthand, and I knew I wanted absolutely no part of it in my life ever. But it didn't seem to be able to work out quite that way. In growing up, I was an observer of people. I'm an only child, and most of the people I know today that I was observing were alcoholics. And I didn't learn that until after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And a lot of the things that I'm comfortable with today that seem to explain things to me that I needed to have explained are things that I've learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been able to understand some of the feelings and some of the ways they reacted before coming into this program, at least explanations that are comfortable for me. And when I was observing people, I noticed that men and women in my life were handling the exact same situations in entirely different ways. To the best of my recollection, before coming into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I do not ever remember seeing a man cry. In fact, the only emotion I ever recall seeing a man have was anger and rage. I took that to mean that that's all men ever felt. that no matter what you did, you could never hurt them, you could never matter in their life, that the most you could do was perhaps you'd get them to hit you in the face once in a while if they cared about you. But outside of that, I really did not think you could have any kind of an emotional effect on a man. And although the women in my life acted with a lot of violence and a lot of rage and hostility, I knew that they felt things. I knew that people that they cared about could hurt them. I knew that I could hurt them if they cared about me. And I saw some of them cry. I saw some of them have nervous breakdowns. I looked at those two different groups of people, and I decided immediately which one I wanted to be like. And I spent my life before coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, and even after coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, and maybe even sometimes still today, trying to be what I thought a man was. And to me, that was someone who cared about no one, who felt absolutely nothing, and if they did feel anything, never let anyone know it. The interesting thing about that is that unfortunately for me, setting these goals for myself, I was one of those people who seemed to have been born without any insulation for my emotions whatsoever. If I really want to think about it today, I can tell you about when I was 5 and 6 years old, which is the first time I had to go out there in the world, and I met kids, and I started to go to school. I can remember the way that they teased me, and I can remember who they were. I can remember probably what they were wearing if I really want to concentrate, and I can tell you exactly the names they called me and the things that they teased me about. Because I remember to this day, if I really want to concentrate, which I don't fortunately anymore, on how much pain I felt. I felt like I was being ripped apart inside. And these were people I didn't even care about. I didn't even know who they were. And so I found out at that age of 5 and 6 when I first went out in the world that I was the thing that I hated the most in the entire world. There's never been anything in my life that I could tolerate less in anyone than those things that I decided were weaknesses. And to me, the idea of showing your emotions to anyone else when you didn't want to was a weakness, and it was one I could not tolerate, and I found out at a very early age that I was one of those things, that I was the weakest kind of person. And that for me was when my self-hatred began. Those are the earliest feelings I remember having about myself, and those were when my suicide attempts began. When I was a little kid, my family and different people would ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I told them a boy. It was not as easy to do back then as it is today. It caused a lot of concern in my family. They began taking me to priests and to psychologists and to psychiatrists to try and help me work this thing out. I have been to a number of psychiatrists and psychologists. I don't have a diagnosis to give you because, like my friend Patty, back in Los Angeles, I was one of those people who always felt they should have to work for their money, and I never told them anything. They would ask me questions, and they would ask me to put little things together and dance for things, and I wouldn't say a word. And when they got bored, they'd just get up, and I would walk out. I didn't like those people, and I didn't want them knowing anything about what was going on in my life. Fortunately for me, I was introduced to drugs when I was 7 years old. I began to drink on a regular basis when I was 8. It was not the first time that I drank, but it was the first time that I got drunk. And that was something that I was to continue to do until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. By the time I was 9, I was to have found a combination that I was never to alter in any way. And that was barbiturates, or sleeping pills, whatever you might know them as, and alcohol. And the combined effect of those chemicals got me exactly where I wanted to go. I've never been a social drinker. I don't have any funny stories to tell you about what I was doing out there, because anybody who knows about taking those kind of chemicals and mixing them with alcohol knows you can't do much, and I didn't. I've done a lot of overdosing. I did a lot of throwing up, some blacking out, and that's really pretty much my story. You know, I was not one of those people. I wasn't a party girl, and I didn't drink so that I could feel good, and I know I was that. But for me, I drank so I didn't have to feel anything at all. I just wanted out. I had always wanted out. I obviously was not successful at all my suicide attempts, and I sincerely believe that I meant those suicide attempts, you know, and I couldn't get out. And fortunately for me, I found alcohol and I found chemicals, because I honestly believe that someone like me would have had to have been locked up and perhaps never would have gotten out, because I really couldn't handle it out there. I just couldn't take the pain. I never liked life. You know, it was a lot of the same things Tom was talking about. I never liked the way I looked. I never liked where I was living. I never liked what we had. I never liked what we didn't have. And most of all, I never, for one instant, liked the way that I felt inside. And the very first time in my entire life that everything felt all right was at 8 years old, that first time I got drunk. And that's the first time that I remember all the pain going away. It just, nothing mattered. I didn't feel good. I just didn't feel anything at all. And if you think I was going to give that up, you're crazy. And I know nobody in this room does, because none of you gave it up. I drank for complete oblivion. I grew up in a little town in Los Angeles called Venice. And for those of you who might not know, it's a beach town. And in that town growing up, I grew up in an alcoholic home, and we grew up on welfare. And most of my friends' parents were alcoholics or something in that neighborhood, and so I sort of hung out with that crowd. And when I found out and finally accepted somehow that I was not going to be able to be a boy, I had to settle for the next best thing. And the way that I saw the world, there was only one alternative, and that was to be a tough broad. And that's what I spent my time doing before coming into this program, was trying to be what I thought a tough broad was. Now, I suppose tough broads out here in Panama City are very different from Venice tough broads, but I'll tell you the way that I was doing things. It was a beach town, and because of that, if you were going to be a tough broad in Venice, you could never wear shoes, and I did not. I went barefoot everywhere. I did a lot of smoking, which all of us did, I suppose. And one of my favorite things to do was to stand down there on the beach with my gang, looking tough. I had practiced. I don't know about them. And naturally, I was in a gang, because if you're going to be a tough broad, it's really crucial. And I would stand there with my gang looking tough, and sometimes touristy kind of people would sort of walk by and notice us, and I'd look them right in the eye, and I would take my cigarette, and I would throw it down on the sidewalk, and I would put it out with my bare feet. And these touristy kind of people would sort of poke one another and whisper back and forth, and I knew what they were saying. They were saying, "Wow, that is one tough broad." And I was very impressed that I could do this, and I was sure that they would be impressed too, you know. It wasn't until after I'd been sober for a couple of years that my sponsor convinced me that maybe what some of those people were saying to one another was, "Did you see that? That person just put flesh to fire. Why would anybody do anything so stupid?" But I thought it was a very tough thing to do, and so I did it all the time. Of course, just being able to step on a lit cigarette butt did not truly mean you were tough. You were only really tough if you could then walk upon those feet as if it did not hurt. And and these are the things that kept me busy when I was out there drinking. I did a lot of fighting. I have never won a fight in my life. But I never fought less than five people at a time. And I learned after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous that the reason I always fought groups of from 5 to 15 was because if you fight that many people, no one expects you to win. And if you take a chance and you fight one person and you lose, somebody might think you're a lousy fighter. So I was one of those people that was willing to walk around with my face bashed in a lot because it managed to convince other people that I must be tough, or why would five have had to jump me? And that was sort of the way I was kind of getting by out there. I've always been grateful, not always, but I have been grateful in later years in Alcoholics Anonymous that tattoos were not popular when I was on the street. They became popular a couple years after I got sober for women, and a lot of my girlfriends in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous have tattoos. Most of them have little things like a butterfly or a flower, and one has a panda bear, and you know, they're very cute little works of art, really. But if tattoos had been popular, on my arm, and it would swim whenever I did this. And I would have gotten something like a battleship on my chest, or maybe a canoe in my case, but if I had thought that it was tough, I have absolutely no doubt in my mind that I would have done it. The last fight that I had, my gang came by my door where I was living, and they knocked on the door that morning, and they said, "If you come out of the house, we're going to beat you up." And I closed the door, and I immediately got ready to go outside, because there wasn't any way in the whole world that I would sit in that room and let somebody think I was afraid. I never let anyone think I was afraid. I tried never to ever recognize fear. That wasn't something a man would do, and that wasn't something I was going to recognize. And it talks about in certain places in the book, and I'm not a very good verbatim quoter, but it talks about, you know, having a normal reaction to fear, you know, and recognizing that. And I was completely without that before coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, and even for some time after. But at that point in time, I had, in the way that I saw the world, there was absolutely no choice but to go outside immediately. God forbid someone should think I was afraid sitting in there, afraid of fighting or afraid of getting beat up. You just couldn't be tough if you were afraid. And so I came outside. And as I started to walk down the street, my gang started to follow me. And as they were following me, I thought to myself, I can either take the street or I can take the alley. And if I don't take the alley, they're going to think it's because I'm afraid to take that alley. and I didn't want anyone to ever think I was afraid to do anything. And so I took the alley, and all five of them beat me up. And as I laid in that alley and one of them was pounding my head against the pavement, all they wanted that day, and God knows, you know, why they chose whatever they chose, but on that particular day, all they wanted me to do was cry. And I didn't cry. And I don't know how long they hit me. Till they got bored, though, they finally got up and they walked away. And I got up from that fight, and I had a split lip that was bleeding, and I had a black eye, and my face was sort of swollen. But if you'd asked me right that moment, I would have told you I won. Because I didn't fight. I didn't give them what they wanted. And that, to me, was the most important thing I could possibly think of at that point in my life. And, you know, it seems sort of funny today, because, I mean, if somebody walked up to me and they said, look, June, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. You're either going to punch you in the face a few times or you can cry a few tears. I'd cry a few tears. Who cares? You know. What's the big deal? But at that point in my life, if they had chose to beat me, I think I would have let them beat me to death rather than cry. It was just that important. It was all that I had to hang on to. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. My mother brought me. I didn't come here because I had a problem. I didn't come here because I wanted help. Because even if I had had a problem, I wouldn't have joined any organization that was allowing my mother to be a member. By the time I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the only person in the world I hated more than my mother was myself. I blamed my mother for everything that had ever gone wrong in my life. It was extremely convenient to have an alcoholic there to blame everything on. I wasn't responsible for anything. I was sort of like the 12 and 12 talked about. I was just a victim of the world and its circumstances. It was really all her fault. It took a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous before I could start taking responsibility for my own actions and for the way my own life had gone. And by the way, in case I forget, my mom is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, a lot of times I leave her out there drinking. And if she continues to do what she's been doing one day at a time, this December she'll celebrate 10 continuous years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. But at that particular point in time, my mother was coming back. She had been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for almost 10 years at that time with varying lengths of sobriety. She was coming back from a slip after 2 years of sobriety. And she made me come to a meeting with her. I went to that meeting mainly because she forced me, because she was afraid if she left me alone in the apartment, I'd get her evicted from another place. And I sat in that meeting, and I didn't raise my hand, certainly. And I didn't want anything really to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. But the miracle of this program began to happen for me at that particular night, even though I didn't get sober then. And it began to happen for me because there was a man in that meeting that I admired more than anybody else in the whole world. And I did not admire a whole lot of people. And the reasons I admired this man, I know many of you will not identify with or not be very happy with, but they were my reasons, and they were the thing that kept me coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I admired Paul because he was from my neighborhood. He was from Venice. He was extremely violent. He'd been in prison. He rode a motorcycle. He had tattoos. He carried a knife, and he had it with him at the meeting that night. And I looked at him, and I thought, wow, I never thought people this great came to AA. I thought it was for weak people like my mom, and it made a big impression on me. And, of course, I got drunk the next night. I wasn't that impressed, but it made a difference. And I came back to those meetings, and I didn't raise my hand, but I went to lots and lots of meetings. Paul was just getting sober at that time, going to lots and lots of meetings, and so I went to lots and lots of meetings. And in between the meetings, I spent a lot of time trying to explain to Paul all the reasons why I wasn't anything like my mother, who was an alcoholic. I was far too young to be an alcoholic. I had all these different things, you know, that I explained to him. I later found out that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time trying to convince other people that they're not alcoholics. They already know that, you know. And finally, Paul turned to me and he said, you know what, June? He said, I'll tell you. He said, they've told me in Alcoholics Anonymous that I can't diagnose anybody's disease but my own. He said, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. He said, I've seen the way that you drink, and I've seen the way that you take pills. And I happen to believe if you don't come into this program and take what these people have done 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be selling your ass, and you'll be shooting stuff. And I knew he wasn't trying to scare me. He wasn't trying to make something up like, you know, some of the teachers might do in school to scare the kids. He was just talking about facts. He was talking about things that had happened in his life. He was talking about things that had happened and were beginning to happen in mine. And I thought a little bit about what he said, but I did not want to be an alcoholic. I did not want to join Alcoholics Anonymous. And in this 2 week period of time, absolutely every alternative but Alcoholics Anonymous was removed from my life. I had come back and was living with my mother at this time. I had been with her for a very short period of time. And as I said, she was just getting sober. And because of the way that I felt about my mother, I had a lot of rage and I had a lot of hatred, and I used to attack her physically on a very regular basis. And because she was sober at this time, she no longer felt so guilty that she had to be subjected to those attacks, and she told me I would have to leave her home. And I did. My family had not talked to me in about 3 years at that time. I was not allowed to call or come by under any circumstances, and I didn't even bother to try. I'd been thrown out of about 6 foster homes at that time, and none of them would take me back. I tried to get into some of the drug rehab and alcohol recovery homes that were available in the Los Angeles area at that time. None of them would take me, some because of my age and some just because of my attitude. And then I thought, well, you know what? Who needs this program and who needs these people and who needs this family stuff? Because none of that really matters. There's only one thing that really matters to any tough broad, and that's my gang. And then as I was walking down that alley that day, I told you what happened to me and my gang. And so I found myself sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 87 pounds. I had a black eye. I had a swollen lip. I didn't have shoes and wouldn't have worn them at the time if I'd had them. I had no place to live. I had no family. I had no money. I had nothing. And I started to raise my hand in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you can see where it was really kind of simple at that point. It wasn't like, would you like to go to Hawaii or join AA? It was much easier than that. There are a couple things I want to talk about a little bit about that, joining AA and coming in at that time. First of all, when I first came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would talk about the fact that I had taken pills just as I did tonight. I don't do that because I want to impress you with what a cool dope fiend I was. I was never a cool dope fiend, and I never really got in caught up in that kind of an ego trip. I share that with you just because it's part of my experience. It's what happened in my sobriety and before. And I later found out, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I first came in, there were people who were, you know, saying you couldn't talk about that because it was for pure alcoholics only and they didn't want you to mess around with that stuff. I was real worried and guilty that maybe I wasn't supposed to talk about it, but I later found out after staying sober that really the only people who care about you mentioning the fact that you'd used other chemicals in Alcoholics Anonymous are the ones who are still taking them. So I don't worry about it now. When I started to raise my hand in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous at that particular time, there were some people in Alcoholics Anonymous who I know today didn't know about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, in particular the third tradition, the one that says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And the reason I know they didn't know about that tradition is because when I first started to raise my hand in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, there were some people who came up to me after meetings, and they told me that I was too young to be an alcoholic, and that they didn't want a little kid sitting in their meetings while they talked about serious things. And they told me if I came back, they would throw me out. And I didn't know they couldn't do that. I certainly didn't know Alcoholics Anonymous had a set of traditions. I just figured Alcoholics Anonymous didn't want me either. And that was fine with me, because I didn't want me either. I hadn't for a long, long time. And I fell back on my number one answer. It was the answer I'd been using since I was 5 years old. I went over to a friend of my mother's. I went into her bathroom, which is the first place I went at anyone's house I ever visited. And I found the kind of pills that I needed. And I took an overdose to kill myself one more time. And before I passed out that day, I went to a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. By the time I got to the meeting, I couldn't stand and I couldn't sit. I had to lay down. And I don't know about where you got sober, but in West Los Angeles, where I got sober, they almost never called on people to share who were laying in the meeting. But for some reason that day, they called on me. And I certainly can't tell you what I said. The next thing I remember was I was waking up in a hospital and Paul had taken me to, and the doctor was giving me medication to make me throw up and explaining to me that the pills I had taken were to slow down my heart. And had I been there 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably couldn't have brought me out of. And I really don't know why that overdose was so different than any of the other overdoses that I'd inflicted upon myself during the years that I was out there, but I know that it was. Because since that time, I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up, and that's how I personally define sobriety. I've done that one day at a time. The 13th of July of this year, I celebrated 14 continuous years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, sort of like Tom was saying this morning, when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I certainly wasn't planning on staying 14 years. I wasn't planning on living 14 more years, you know. I think that the longer I stay sober, the more grateful I am to the people who were here when I came in. And the more grateful I am particularly to the people who tolerated me when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a lot of different kinds of newcomers that come into Alcoholics Anonymous. There's the kind that are the lovable kind, that you just want to hug and they keep crying, you just hand them Kleenex and pat them, you know, that kind. And then there's some that kind of fall into my variety, and they have various ranges, I'm sure, but I was one of the newcomers that had to be tolerated rather than loved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm very grateful to the people who were able to tolerate me, and not everybody was. You know, it seems sort of funny to me because telling you how I came into this program, I had absolutely no one that I can think of that I could have possibly turned to for anything when I first came into these meetings. There wasn't anybody I knew that wanted anything to do with me. And it would seem like, as a logical person, someone like that would be so grateful for some of the love and kindness that some of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous tried to share, but that was not to be the case with me. I came into this program with a bad attitude. Now, I don't want you to think I got sober and I got a bad attitude, because that would be misleading. I simply came here with the only attitude I had ever had, and for as long as I had known, it had been bad. When I was out there, when you're 87 pounds, you don't do a lot of physical damage to people. And so in trying to be a tough broad, I had learned to be able to destroy people, or what I thought was destroy them verbally. I had a very critical tongue. I was very vulgar and profane, and I was extremely proud of that. It was something I had worked on and tried and struggled for, and I thought I was very good at it when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous until I met my sponsor. And then it was sort of like a goldfish playing with a shark. You know, I was way out of my league, but I thought I was very good at it. When I came to the program, I continued to go barefoot for almost 2 years, and I still wore my motorcycle jacket from my gang that said on the back, "Do unto others," and then split. I wore a couple of motorcycle chains, big ones, all the time. And I had my black eye and my swollen lip for quite a while. I found that I had a very limited vocabulary when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. It consisted almost solely of profanity, exception of a few other words like the and mother. And that was about it. I found a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous were extremely offended by the use of that kind of language, and I tried to use it more when they were around. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day when I came to the program. I lit all of them myself. Occasionally someone would light a match and hold it for me, and I allowed them to hold it as long as they liked. But they never lit my cigarette with it. Sometimes someone would hold the door open for me, and I allowed them to hold it until their arm got tired. And when that door closed, I opened it for myself only, and I went through the door. I didn't ask for rides most of the time. I didn't accept rides. I either walked, or I hitchhiked, or if I had enough money, I took a bus. And really, I know today what I was trying to let everybody know here in Alcoholics Anonymous was that I was just fine all by myself. I didn't need anybody. I was just fine all by myself. And of course, that's rather silly, because if I'd been doing all that well by myself, I never would have ended up here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm sure I didn't really fool anybody. But as I said, I was trying really as best as I could to keep people away from me. I also, after I'd been sober a short period of time, took up smoking cigars, big cigars, and then later a pipe. And I'll tell you, I was able to sit in meetings, not nearly this large, but we had some fairly large meetings in Los Angeles, in those meetings, and have almost an entire row all to myself sometimes. Now, there's, when I came back to Japan, it would be wrong for me to try and tell you that at that point suddenly everybody accepted the fact that I was an alcoholic. I'm sure that there are people still today in Alcoholics Anonymous who will never possibly believe that I, at my age, could have been an alcoholic. And that's just not important. What I've learned is that fortunately for me, and really for each and every one of us, Alcoholics Anonymous has a third tradition. That's the one that says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And you know, I was thinking about this. John and I won this book last night, and this is one of my favorite parts that I think about and I read a lot when sometimes when I'm asked to share, and sometimes just at home on my own. You know, they in Alcoholics Anonymous, when they were first writing these traditions, I want to read you what they were thinking about when they were thinking about tradition 3. I know many of you have already heard this, but We were resolved to admit nobody to AA but that hypothetical class of people we termed pure alcoholics. Except for their guzzling and the unfortunate results thereof, they could have no other complications. So, beggars, tramps, asylum inmates, prisoners, queers, plain crackpots, and fallen women were definitely out. Yes, sir, we cater only to pure and respectable alcoholics. Any others would surely destroy us. Besides, if we took in those odd ones, what would decent people say about us? We built a fine mesh fence right around AA. Now, whenever I read that list of requirements that they were going to exclude, I'm always overcome with the feeling that they would have excluded my sponsor and all my closest friends in Alcoholics Anonymous if they had decided to keep those requirements. And I'm so grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous kept it simple and kept that requirement. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about the fact that we are people who normally would not mix. And in my sobriety, there have been a number of people who have changed my life in a lot of different ways with whom I would normally not have ever mixed with. And one of those was my first sponsor. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not like women. I didn't like me. I didn't like my mother. I figured any other women in Alcoholics Anonymous had to be like one of the two of us, and I didn't want anything to do with women. I didn't sit next to women. I didn't talk to women. I didn't shake hands with women. I certainly didn't hug women. I wanted nothing to do with them. I tried not to listen to them when they spoke, something that always makes me feel better. I know there are never as many people listening to me as it looks like out there. I had very high standards for who I would listen to, you know, and it's sort of funny because a lot of them had nothing to do with my story, but I only listened to men. I usually only listened to them if they had tattoos and had been in prison and had lived on the streets. I was one of the worst kind of snobs when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you had a car, I didn't like you. We'd never had a car. And as far as I was concerned, you'd had an easy life. You'd never suffered the way I had suffered. And I was just that kind of a snob when I came here. And it took a long, long time in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had to be taught a lot of lessons like that, mostly from my sponsor. But my sponsor was one of the people that they meant in the big book when they said we were people who normally would not mix. Gail was a woman who was almost three times my age when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We had nothing in common. She was from the South. She didn't, not only did she not use the same language I used, she didn't know what most of the words I was using meant. I would go to the Brentwood meeting and see her, and I would walk up to her with my cigar and motorcycle jacket, and she would say to me, "June, don't sit next to me at the meeting tonight. I can't stand the cigar smoke." And I'd say, "That's okay." And she'd say, not only that, when I'd be turning around to walk away, she'd say, "Please don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor." And that was fine with me because I didn't want anyone to know I was hanging around with someone lame like her, you know. And so we would meet secretly after meetings and talk about AA. I got very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous from the very beginning, and my sponsors were very active, and my home group at that time was one of the best meetings in the entire world, and I think that's the way we should always feel about our home group, the Monday Night Venice group, and it was a wonderful group. And I got real active. I went to lots and lots of meetings. I went to 21 meetings a week most of my first 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. At my Tuesday night meeting that I went to regularly, they made me the greeter. I would stand there at the door with my motorcycle jacket and chains and cigar, barefoot, welcoming the newcomer. And sometimes as they'd walk by, I'd hear their sponsor whisper to me, "See, if you keep drinking, you can end up like this." You know, for some reason, this story has just been popping in my mind. It has absolutely nothing to do with what I'm talking about, which is very common, but I don't usually admit it. But I was thinking about Serenity Sam today, and he's one of the old-timers from my home group, the Monday Night Dance group. And Sam had told this story about this 12-step call that has just been popping in and out of my mind all weekend. And it sort of has to do with, you know, how people who are supposed to be in AA get here and And it doesn't mean anything, doesn't have anything to do with a lot of times what we do or how we do it, you know. Sam was, when he was brand new in the program, the excitement stage where he just wanted to sell everybody AA, you know, you gotta get everybody in here. You know, you see somebody in there buying a six pack of beer, of course they're having 25 people over for dinner, you wanna bring them to meet them, you know. He got a phone call one day from central office in Los Angeles and they said, Sam, we got a guy, his mother called for him and, she says that he needs AA, we'd like you to go over and talk to him. And Sam said, well, great, great, where's his address? And they gave him his address and they said, now Sam, it's one thing we didn't tell you, we want you to be careful because this guy has a shotgun. And so Sam said, that didn't bother Sam that much really, and he raced right out there, and just when he got to the house, the shotgun went off. He heard the shotgun go, he decided he wasn't going to knock right then. So what he did was he took out a little piece of paper and he wrote on it, Sam, AA, and his phone number, and he stuck it in the screen door and then he took off. About 2 days later, he gets this call from the drunk. Hello? Sam? Falling down in the phone booth, and he picked the guy up, and he took him home, and he filled him full of coffee, and took him to a meeting, and they were talking. They spent the night with him, and the next day, Sam was giving him some more coffee, and, you know, I was wondering how long it was going to take you to call. He says, you know, I was sort of scared that day when I went over your house and the shotgun went off. And the guy says, shotgun? He says, What are you talking about? And Sam says, you know, well, central office told me that, you know, your mom called and I went over to your house to make this 12-step call. And he says, oh, no. He says, I was just sitting in that bar and I saw your name on this piece of paper on the bar and I picked it up and called you. And I just thought that some reason that's just one of those stories that sticks in my mind just about how sometimes when we're supposed to get here, we end up getting here. I got active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mother was sober just at this time. And my mom got sober, and she got rigorously honest, and my mother and I had come into the United States from Canada when I was 2 years old illegally, and when my mom got rigorously honest, she turned us into the immigration authorities, and then my mom got drunk, and I went to court, and I was not at the least bit happy about the rigorous honesty part of this program. And I had to deal with that for many, many years, in Alcoholics Anonymous. And just going to these court hearings and going on and on and on. But anyway, when I got to the program at the Monday Night Venice Group, they told me that one of the most important things I could possibly do was to get a big book. And so decided I should do that, but they said that they'd sell it to me at their cost if I couldn't afford it. They said I could just take that at the Venice Group only, really not any of the other meetings. They said, if you're too afraid to talk to us, you can just steal it. I'd been stealing, absolutely no reason to give up stealing because I was getting sober and I didn't. But I thought, you know, if I stole the big book from an AA meeting, it would jinx my sobriety. And so instead I went to the library in Santa Monica and I stole the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And while I was there, I stole a copy of Reason to Make Two Trips. And I was probably close to 2 or 3 years sober before I made amends for that. I didn't feel bad about taking it, you know, for a long, long time. I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous with a seventh grade education, and I refused to go back to school when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I really don't think in a lot of ways I would have been capable of it at all. And so instead I just went to lots and lots of meetings and I got the kind of job that you can get with a seventh grade education. My sponsors were very practical people, you know, I mean, there's all different kinds of sponsors, that we can find, and there's all different kinds of sobriety. In Alcoholics Anonymous, really, you know. And my sponsors were the kind of people that they believed if you wanted something, that you had to do exactly what anybody in or out of AA had to do to get it. You know, that you weren't going to get it special just because you sat around the club more hours than those people outside of AA, that I had to do the same kind of things. And that's sort of the way it seemed to work for me. I went out there and I got the same job anybody else with a seventh grade education could get. They didn't offer me president just because I joined AA. Anyway, I did that for a while, and I stayed real active in doing that, and I'm just like everybody else. I have no idea what time I got up here. I went ahead at that time and did that job, and then after a while I got a chance to go to secretarial school and learn how to be a secretary. If there's anything in my life I never wanted to be, it was a secretary. You've hardly seen any tough broads that are secretaries. And it wasn't what I wanted to do, but I went ahead and I took the classes and I did okay at most of them except for typing. I started out typing 17 words a minute with 9 errors, and I stayed there one day at a time for 14 months in the secretary. And so what I had to do at that point, they told me I could go out and look for an office job. And going out to look for an office job was one of the things that I had to deal with, one of the hardest things that I ever had to deal with in my life. By the time I came to this program, I told you that there wasn't anything that I hated, there wasn't anybody I hated more than myself. And that had a lot to do with the way I treated the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it had a lot to do with my attitude and the reason I was as hostile and I was as vulgar as I was. Because I really didn't want anybody getting that close to me. You know, even after I got sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't take a lot of baths and I didn't take a lot of showers and I didn't wash my hair a lot. Some of it had to do with the fact that nobody ever told me when you're supposed to do that sort of thing. You know, you don't stand out there with your gang and say, do you use Crest or Colgate? It's just not part of the talk. And I didn't want anybody to know how dumb I was about those things, and I didn't know who to ask, and so I didn't ask. But most of it had to do with the fact that I didn't want to take showers and baths because I didn't want to have to wash myself off. Because every time I did, I felt like throwing up and makeup, and there was just no way. I wasn't going to look in a mirror that long. I just couldn't do it. I didn't want to. I had never liked what I had seen, and in getting sober, I had to deal with all those feelings all over again, those same ones I had at 5 and 6 and 7, of hating the way I looked and hating where I was and hating how I felt, and I had to start to deal with those things. And I'll tell you, when I sat in these meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous and I heard these people get up here and they talked, you know, sort of like when Nora was talking about looking that guy in the blue eyes, you know, last night, I'd listen to these people and I'd think, you know, that's never going to happen for me. Never going to happen where I like myself, or I want to be my own friend and I can look people in the eye. But maybe if I go to lots and lots of these meetings and I stay real close to this program, maybe someday I won't feel like throwing up when I look in a mirror and I see myself looking back. And that was the hope for me. That was what kept me coming back. And I did that when I finished this secretarial class. I had to go out and look for a job, and it was really difficult for me. I didn't feel good enough to be standing in companies. I didn't know any citizen-y type people. I never had, and citizens to me were people who work Monday through Friday in the daytime. I'd never known any. I didn't know how to act like them. Some women on the program took me out and bought me some clothes. We went over to the Salvation Army, and they helped me pick out some things, and they gave me some other things to wear. I put these clothes on. It was like Halloween. You know, look at the little Venice bride dressed up in the citizen costume, you know, and I felt like it was so obvious. But I went ahead, and I went out on these interviews, and it was just real hard dealing with those feelings. But I got a job, and I worked real hard at this first job that I got, and I was so excited. It was so square. It was in an insurance company. I knew my sponsor would be thrilled, you know, On the seventh day, they called me in the office, and I thought maybe they were going to give me a raise, and they fired me. And I absolutely could not believe it. She said, I'm sorry, we're going to have to let you go. You don't have enough experience, and not only that, dear, you don't seem to have any common sense whatsoever. And I didn't know what common sense was, but I knew I was being insulted, you know. And I left there. I went across the street, and I immediately called the L.A. Central office. I said, this is June G. I'm a sober member. I've just been fired, and what are you going to do about that? And they just laughed like you guys did, you know. I've been sober a couple years at that point. I had never heard of anybody sober in AA being fired. I didn't think they could do that to us. I thought we'd pick it or something, you know. I remember talking to my sponsor that night, and I said, you know, I never got fired before I came to this AA. And he reminded me I'd never had a job. And sponsors always have insights like that, you know. Anyway, I went on, I got another job, and somewhere along the line I decided I wanted to get a driver's license, and the only way I could do that was take a class over at the local city college, and while I was there I decided to take an English class and see if I could learn to read again. I had known how to remember all the words, so I did that, and I started to go to school that way. I worked full time, I put myself through school. By this time I found a garage that I could live in for $40 a month, and some people in the program, one of them bought me a lamp, and somebody else brought me a piece of carpet, and somebody else gave me twin bed, put it together like that, and I went ahead and I went to this school at night, and I worked full time in the daytime, and I kept that up for a while, and at the end of about 3 years they called me in the office and they told me that I'd finished all the requirements for what they called an AA college degree, and I thought that was a nice name for a college degree. I had never in my life planned on having a college degree. I mean, really, when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, if they just said, would you like to have a switchblade, I mean, I would have wanted the switchblade. It just wasn't even on my list, but it was something that I was grateful that I could do, and something that I knew without any question of a doubt that only Alcoholics Anonymous could have made possible in my life. By the time I came to this program, I already said I couldn't read one whole sentence and remember from the first word to the last. And in my life, as I was out there, you know, living with my mom, I had never finished. I had never gone to school an entire week in my life without missing some portion of a day. I had always played hooky or played sick or played whatever it was, but I was not a in that 3 years, I don't believe I missed one class that I was supposed to go to. And that was something that I never wanted. It was just something that Alcoholics Anonymous made possible, and it means a lot to me today. And I went ahead and I went on to school. I finished college a couple of years later. And somewhere along the line, I'd come up with a dream. I went ahead and I filled out the applications for this dream, just like my sponsors had taught me. I did all the footwork that anybody else would have to do. And I got some telegrams. Gosh, it's been probably about 6 years ago now. And one of them told me that I'd been chosen as one of 300 out of 3,000 applicants to go to law school. And I'll tell you, when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had always planned on spending a lot of time in court. But never on that side of the table. And that's what I've been doing over the last time. Linda came into AA, and Linda was and is one of the most beautiful women I have ever seen in my life. She's blonde, and she is beautiful, and she dresses just like nobody I can think of offhand. She'd grown up in Santa Barbara. She comes from a fairly wealthy family. Her family was very close and very loving, and she was a stewardess, and she traveled all over the world, and she came into AA, and she asked my sponsor to be her sponsor. And that was fine. You know, my sponsor could sponsor anybody that she wanted to. But then my sponsor wanted me to be friends with this woman. And I didn't see any reason to. And my sponsor and I had a lot of fights about this. It's like, why? I don't want to be friends with her. I don't want to be seen with her. For God's sake, you know. I mean, I walk into meetings and everybody comes up and says, who's that? Who's your friend? I mean, hell, I hadn't had a date in years at this point, you know, and everybody's asking for Linda's phone number. So, and you know, Linda hadn't suffered. I knew that. I mean, you could just look at this woman and know she'd never suffered. Jeez, it was plain as day. And my sponsor got mad at me. He did that a lot, you know. And drove her to it, I guess, a few times. And she said, you know, June said, I can't believe it. She said, I don't think I've ever met anybody like you. She said, has it ever occurred to you that it really doesn't matter whether somebody tried to kill themselves in Venice or in a hotel room in Paris? And I thought, well, no. It never occurred to me. And she said, can't you understand that Linda had exactly the same feelings when she was trying to kill herself in that hotel room in Paris as you had down there in Venice? And I forgot I had never thought of that. I never thought anybody could have the same feelings that I had unless they were from Venice or from the streets like I was. And today Linda's one of my closest friends. And again, she's one of those people I normally would not have mixed with, just like Neil. But anyway, I went ahead and I went on. I went into law school and I worked very, very hard at it. And there were a lot of times I wasn't sure that that was where I was supposed to be. I was thinking it was a fluke or a little joke by God to make fun of me. But I went and I worked real hard because my sponsor told me that it was an AA commitment, that AA had gotten me into law school and I was to do the very best that I could one day at a time while I was there, and that's what I did. I was scheduled to graduate in May of 1983 from law school. In early 1983, I got a phone call and I was told that my sponsor, Gail, was dying of cancer. And Gail was 48 years old, and she had been sick with cancer, but she had told me that she was in remission because she didn't want to worry me and worry my studies. And I went in during those last couple of months, and we spent a lot of time in the hospital with her while she was passing away. And we did a lot of talking, and we talked a lot about AA, naturally, because it was what we both had in common. And you know, Gail told me, I mean, we just talked about so many things. You know, we'd sit there, and all these doctors and nurses that were taking care of her would come in and out to do whatever they had to do to take care of her. And Gail insisted on introducing me to every one of them, even though I'm sure they had no interest in meeting me whatsoever. But she'd say, Dr. Smith, I want you to meet Junie. So Junie's like a daughter to me, and she's going to be an attorney. And I sit there, and I just sort of smile and think, you know, this is the same woman who used to say, don't sit next to me at the meeting, and don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor. And here she is introducing me to strangers, you know. And Gail and I, we talked, and we, you know, she was telling me a lot of things that she'd never told me before. And she said, you know, and she said, When you came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and when you asked me to be your sponsor, I really didn't want to. I know that's going to surprise a lot of you. She said, but so I was taught that I had to accept, you know, and you could see where I wasn't maybe baby of the year in 72. But she said she did. She went ahead and sponsored me. She said, but, you know, she said, with your background and your attitude, I knew you were going absolutely nowhere. She said, but I decided I had to sponsor you because that's the way I'd been taught. And so then I remember after you were a couple years sober, so I remember you telling me you were going to take a class in college, and I thought, she'll never finish it. Never finished anything in her life. But I didn't tell you. I just knew it. And so then I remember you took two or three classes, or however many it was, you took a couple and you finished them, and then so I remember you saying, Gail, I want to go to law school someday. And she said, June, I had to force myself not to laugh out loud. So she said, I knew you could never do that. But she never told me that. She never, ever, I remember her ever saying anything like, you can't do that, or you could never do that. And what we talked about was the fact that Gail knew that I couldn't do that. Gail always knew that I couldn't do anything. But she never said anything because she knew Alcoholics Anonymous could. Alcoholics Anonymous can accomplish all kinds of things in our lives. And it has, you know. Gail passed away in April of 1983, and I went on and I graduated in May of 1983. And I went on to take the bar. And actually the last time that I was studying for the bar, I was here in Pensacola. And studying for that bar exam. And I took it, I guess, about 2 weeks after the conference. It was the second time that I had taken it. The first time I took it, I got a telegram telling me that I did not pass, and I absolutely could not believe it. It was one of the most difficult things I ever went through in my sobriety, and I know it had a lot to do with ego, but that didn't make it feel any better, you know. I thought for sure when I got that letter that said I did not pass, that really what it said was a letter from God saying, you made a big mistake, you should have just stuck with being a waitress, because somebody like you could never make anything like that out of yourself. And that's really the way I read it, and I went to a meeting that night, and I didn't want to, but it was the way I'd been taught. You know, sort of like Tom was saying, you got to keep that foundation in your sobriety so that you do what you need to do when you don't even want to do it, and you can't feel like you can do it. And that's what I did. I went to a meeting that night, and I didn't tell a lot of people. I mean, I think everybody in the whole world knew that I couldn't talk. And I couldn't sleep. I'd wake myself up crying in the middle of the night. And I didn't understand. You know, I had done all of the footwork that I could possibly do. And I knew that all it could mean was that this was not God's will for me. And I didn't know what God's will was. It was that meeting I went to that night. I talked to my two best friends. And I explained to them that the telegram really meant I was supposed to go be a waitress. And they explained to me that it really meant I was supposed to take the test again. I knew that they were wrong, but here it was. It was December 1st at that time in 1983. I had enough money to pay my rent, and I didn't have one dime extra, not one dime, you know. And here I was. I was 10 years sober. I couldn't put a dollar in a basket if I wanted to. I couldn't feed myself. I didn't have any money for gas, you know. And I was just flat out embarrassed. I thought, this is absolutely ridiculous that somebody 10 years in Alcoholics Anonymous can't even support themselves. You know, I'm just a complete failure. And that was why I just didn't feel proud to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. I just felt like I'd let everybody down, and most of all, Gail, you know, who'd really believed in me. And yet these friends of mine told me, you know, they said, why don't you borrow a couple more $1,000? You already owe more than you can pay now, so you might as well borrow more. So I thought, what the hell? So I did. And I took the test again in February of 1984. In June of 1984, I got a telegram telling me that I had passed the exam. And I'll tell you, having not passed and passed, I would like to be able to stand up here and tell you that spiritually my program was exactly the same on both occasions. But in all honesty, I felt so much better about AA and God when I passed. I can't even tell you. And I've been practicing since that time. I got a telegram with that when you passed. There's still one more thing that you have to do in order to practice law, and that's that you have to be sworn in. It's really just another way to get a couple $100 from you. And that telegram told me that the swearing-in ceremony would take place on June 13th. That would have been Gail's 21-year AA birthday if she lived. And so a lot of times I think maybe that's why I didn't pass that first time, maybe so I could be sworn in on that day that was so special to Gail. I'm just going to tell you one other thing real quick. You know, when I was 7 years sober, I asked my mom to give me a cake at the Monday Night Venice group. And my mom and I, you know, we're friends today, but I'm not going to stand up here and tell you it's like Ozzy and Harriet, because it's just not, you know. I like my mother better today than I have ever liked her, and I'm pretty sure she likes me better today than she's ever liked me. But it isn't, you know, that kind of fantasy thing that I sort of thought was going to happen, you know, like Ozzie and Harriet. I kept expecting my mom to put on an apron and bake cookies. And that ain't my mom. It's never been, and it ain't going to be. And I had to learn in Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought a lot about this when Vinoy was up here, I had to learn from the women in Alcoholics Anonymous who were about my mom's age what had gone on with my mom. See, I always thought, you know, when those things were happening, it was because mom didn't care or because she wanted to hurt me or whatever it was. You know, I mean, how can she say I'll pick you up at 3 and not come for another week? How can you forget about a person, for Christ's sake? You know, and how can you say that somebody loves you when they do that? And those kind of things, those kind of broken promises were probably the things that had hurt the most, you know? And all the violence and those things that had gone on that she never stopped. And I always thought, I never understood that it was because she couldn't. You know, I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 7 years sober, and I never could accept my mother's disease. I still blamed her for all those horrible things that had happened in my life. And when she came down that aisle to give me that cake, the Monday Night Venice group had always been my mom's home group, and it had been the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous I attended when I was 6 years old. And at that meeting at 6 years old, it was the first time I saw Paul standing there with his knife, you know. And as I saw her coming down that aisle, I suddenly realized that had it not been for all the hell that my mom's alcoholism had put me through and her through, I never would have gotten to the Monday Night Venice group when I got there. I may have gotten there 10 or 15 or 20 years later, I don't know. But I sure wouldn't have gotten there when I got there. And I could finally be grateful for what my mom had to go through and what I went through with her, but mostly for what she had to go through. And I could start to be able to forgive her and to love her and to feel some empathy for the life that she had gone on. And it was women in Alcoholics Anonymous, really, that I could hear share that taught me that, you know. And sort of like those things that Vinoy was sharing last night, you know, that those were things that just happened that our disease caused that we didn't really necessarily want to happen or have any control over. And a couple of years ago, I was following my mom to a meeting, and I got behind her in her car, and she has this bumper sticker on her car, and it said, "My daughter is a winner." And I'll tell you, when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous a little over 14 years ago, that would not have been the sticker that my mom would have had on her car. I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous and got sober when I was 13 years old. And when they were guessing my age at that time, some people were guessing me at 37. Now, don't come up to me tonight and tell me I look worse. I've had people do that, but I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous now longer than I was alive when I came here. And I've been very fortunate. I have been given a life that should never have been mine. I think a lot sometimes, you know, I suppose I'm like anybody else. Sometimes I think, you know, maybe I was too young. Hell, maybe it was just a phase that I went through. I was sowing my oats, you know. And I'm probably just a social drinker after all, you know, and those kind of things. And whenever those thoughts come to mind, I take out that part of the book that Bill read for us tonight, and I read the third chapter more about alcoholism. And then I think a little bit about the women that I grew up with in Venice. And I'll tell you tonight, as I think back on those women that I used to hang out with in my gang and some of the other ones, that I can't think of one tonight that's not dead in an institution or out on the streets tonight turning tricks so they can support their habit. And that's where I'm supposed to be. That's where people like me end up. They end up in a house that never has the gas, the phone, and the lights on all at the same time. And I know, because that's where I came from. And that's where I'm supposed to be tonight. And there's only one reason why I'm not in that place. It's not because God likes me any better than those women that I grew up with. It's not because I'm any prettier, any smarter than those women that I grew up with. There's just one thing. I found something called Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you very much, Gene. That was a fantastic message. Are there any announcements that I need to make before we close the meeting?
Look at the cake for the November graduates.
November graduates?
November birthdays. Let the November people get in the room first.
Okay. Okay.
And the rest of y'all are free, and the winner looks if you want their money.
Okay, you heard that. There's one announcement I would like to make. I've been asked to make. Apparently, one of the very good members of the Gulf Breeze group is going in tomorrow for open heart surgery. His name is Ed Turner, and we ask that you pray for him and remember him in your prayers. And now we join me in closing the meeting with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.